Do you think I want to go to some stupid castle and learn to be a...
Her pale eyes roved over the platform, over the cats mewling in their owner's arms, over the owls fluttering and hooting at each other in cages, over the students, some already in their long black robes, loading trunks onto the Scarlet steam engine, or else greeting one another with glad cries after a summer apart.
Do you think I want to be a freak?
Lily's eyes filled with tears as Petunia succeeded in tugging her hand away.
I'm not a freak, said Lily. That's a horrible thing to say. That's where you're going, said Petunia with relish. A special school for freaks. You and that Snape boy. Weirdos. That's what you two are. It's good you're being separated from normal people. It's for our safety.
Lily glanced toward her parents, who were looking around the platform with an air of wholehearted enjoyment, drinking in the scene. Then she looked back at her sister, and her voice was low and fierce.
You didn't think it was such a freak's school when you wrote to the headmaster and begged him to take you?
Petunia turned scarlet.
Beg? I didn't beg. I saw his reply. It was very kind. You shouldn't have read, whispered Petunia. That was my private. How could you?
Lily gave herself away by half-glancing toward where Snape stood nearby. Petunia gasped.
That boy found it. You and that boy have been sneaking in my room.
No, not sneaking.
Now Lily was on the defensive.
Severus saw the envelope, and he couldn't believe a muggle could have contacted Hogwarts, that's all. He says there must be wizards working undercover in the postal service who take care of...
Apparently wizards poke their noses in everywhere, said Petunia,
now as pale as she had been flushed.
Freak!
She spat at her sister, and she flounced off to where her parents stood. The scene dissolved again. Snape was hurrying along the corridor of the Hogwarts Express as it clattered through the countryside. He had already changed into his school robes, had perhaps taken the first opportunity to take off his dreadful muggle clothes. At last he stopped outside a compartment in which a group of rowdy boys were talking. Hunched in a corner seat beside the window was Lily, her face pressed against the window pane. Snape slid open the compartment door and sat down opposite Lily. She glanced at him and then looked back out of the window. She had been crying.
I don't want to talk to you, she said in a constricted voice.
Why not?
Tuny hates me because we saw that letter from Dumbledore.
So what? She threw him a look of deep dislike.
So she's my sister.
She's only a... He caught himself quickly. Lily, too busy trying to wipe her eyes without being noticed, did not hear him.
But we're going, he said,
unable to suppress the exhilaration in his voice.
This is it. We're off to Hogwarts.
She nodded, mopping her eyes, but in spite of herself, she half smiled.
You'd better be in Slytherin, said Snape,
encouraged that she had brightened a little.
Slytherin?
One of the boys sharing the compartment, who had shown no interest at all in Lily or Snape until that point, looked around at the word, and Harry, whose attention had been focused entirely on the two beside the window, saw his father. Slight, black-haired like Snape, but with that indefinable air of having been well cared for, even adored, that Snape so conspicuously lacked.
"Who wants to be in Slytherin? I think I'd leave, wouldn't you?"
James asked the boy lounging on the seats opposite him, and with a jolt, Harry realized that it was Sirius. Sirius did not smile.
"My whole family have been in Slytherin," he said.
"Blimey," said James, "and I thought you seemed all right."
Sirius grinned.
"Maybe I'll break the tradition. Where are you heading, if you've got the choice?"
James lifted an invisible sword.
"Gryffindor, where dwell the brave at heart, like my dad."
Snape made a small, disparaging noise. James turned on him.
"Got a problem with that?"
"No," said Snape, though his slight sneer said otherwise. "If you'd rather be brawny than brainy."
"Where are you hoping to go, seeing as you're neither?"
interjected Sirius. James roared with laughter. Lily sat up, rather flustered, and looked from James to Sirius in dislike.
"Come on, Severus, let's find another compartment."
"Ooh!"
James and Sirius imitated her lofty voice. James tried to trip Snape as he passed.
"See ya, Snivellus,"
a voice called as the compartment door slammed. And the scene dissolved once more. Harry was standing right behind Snape as they faced the candle-lit house tables, lined with rapt faces. Then Professor McGonagall said,
"Evans, Lily!"
He watched his mother walk forward on trembling legs and sit down upon the rickety stool. Professor McGonagall dropped the sorting hat onto her head, and barely a second after it had touched the dark red hair, the hat cried,
"Gryffindor!"
Harry heard Snape let out a tiny groan. Lily took off the hat, handed it back to Professor McGonagall, then hurried toward the cheering Gryffindors. But as she went, she glanced back at Snape, and there was a sad little smile on her face. Harry saw Sirius move up the bench to make room for her. She took one look at him, seemed to recognize him from the train, folded her arms, and firmly turned her back on him. The roll call continued. Harry watched Lupin, Pettigrew, and his father join Lily and Sirius at the Gryffindor table. At last, when only a dozen students remained to be sorted, Professor McGonagall called Snape. Harry walked with him to the stool, watched him place the hat upon his head.
"Slytherin!"
cried the sorting hat, and Severus Snape moved off to the other side of the hall, away from Lily, to where the Slytherins were cheering him, to where Lucius Malfoy, a prefect badge gleaming upon his chest, patted Snape on the back as he sat down beside him. And the scene changed. Lily and Snape were walking across the castle courtyard, evidently arguing. Harry hurried to catch up with them, to listen in. As he reached them, he realized how much taller they both were. A few years seemed to have passed since their sorting. "Thought we were supposed to be friends," Snape was saying. "Best friends."
"We are, Sev. But I don't like some of the people you're hanging round with. I'm sorry, but I detest Avery and Mulcibber."
"Mulcibber? What do you see in him, Sev? He's creepy.
Do you know what he tried to do to Mary MacDonald the other day?"
Lily had reached a pillar and leaned against it, looking up into the thin, sallow face.
"That was nothing," said Snape. "It was a laugh, that's all."
"It was dark magic, and if you think that's funny..."
"What about the stuff Potter and his mates get up to?" demanded Snape.
His color rose again as he said it, unable, it seemed, to hold in his resentment.
"What's Potter got to do with anything?" said Lily.
"They sneak out at night. There's something weird about that Lupin. Where does he keep going?"
"He's ill," said Lily. "They say he's ill."
"Every month, at the full moon," said Snape.
"I know your theory," said Lily, and she sounded cold. "Why are you so obsessed with them anyway? Why do you care what they're doing at night?"
"I'm just trying to show you they're not as wonderful as everyone seems to think they are."
The intensity of his gaze made her blush.
"They don't use dark magic, though."
She dropped her voice.
"And you're being really ungrateful. I heard what happened the other night. You went sneaking down that tunnel by the Whomping Willow, and James Potter saved you from whatever's down there."
Snape's whole face contorted, and he spluttered,
"Saved? Saved? You think he was playing the hero? He was saving his neck and his friends, too. You're not going to. I won't let you."
"Let me? Let me?"
Lily's bright green eyes were slits. Snape backtracked at once.
"I didn't mean. I just don't want to see you made a fool of. He fancies you. James Potter fancies you."
The words seemed wrenched from him against his will.
"And he's not, everyone thinks, big Quidditch hero."
Snape's bitterness and dislike were rendering him incoherent, and Lily's eyebrows were travelling farther and farther up her forehead.
"I know James Potter's an arrogant toe-rag," she said, cutting across Snape. "I don't need you to tell me that. But Mulcibber's and Avery's idea of humour is just evil. Evil, Sev. I don't understand how you can be friends with them."
Harry doubted that Snape had even heard her strictures on Mulcibber and Avery. The moment she had insulted James Potter, his whole body had relaxed, and as they walked away there was a new spring in Snape's step. And the scene dissolved. Harry watched again as Snape left the Great Hall after sitting his OWL in Defense Against the Dark Arts, watched as he wandered away from the castle, and strayed inadvertently close to the place beneath the beech tree where James, Sirius, Lupin and Pettigrew sat together. But Harry kept his distance this time, because he knew what happened after James had hoisted Severus into the air and taunted him. He knew what had been done and said, and it gave him no pleasure to hear it again. He watched as Lily joined the group and went to Snape's defense. Distantly, he heard Snape shout at her in his humiliation and his fury, the unforgivable word, "Mudblood!" The scene changed. "I'm sorry.
I'm not interested."
"I'm sorry."
"Save your breath."
It was nighttime. Lily, who was wearing a dressing gown, stood with her arms folded in front of the portrait of the fat lady at the entrance to Gryffindor Tower.
"I only came out because Mary told me you were threatening to sleep here."
"I was, I would have done. I never meant to call you Mudblood.
It just slipped out."
There was no pity in Lily's voice. "It's too late. I've made excuses for you for years. None of my friends can understand why I even talk to you. You and your precious little Death Eater friends. You see, you don't even deny it. You don't even deny that's what you're all aiming to be. You can't wait to join you-know-who, can you?" He opened his mouth, but closed it without speaking.
"I can't pretend any more. You've chosen your way. I've chosen mine."
"No, listen. I didn't mean to call me Mudblood. But you call every one of my birth Mudblood, Severus. Why should I be any different?" He struggled on the verge of speech, but with a contemptuous look, she turned and climbed back through the portrait hole. The corridor dissolved, and the scene took a little longer to reform. Harry seemed to fly through shifting shapes and colors until his surroundings solidified again, and he stood on a hilltop, forlorn and cold in the darkness, the wind whistling through the branches of a few leafless trees. The adult Snape was panting, turning on the spot, his wand gripped tightly in his hand, waiting for something or for someone. His fear infected Harry too, even though he knew that he could not be harmed, and he looked over his shoulder, wondering what it was that Snape was waiting for. Then a blinding, jagged jet of white light flew through the air. Harry thought of lightning, but Snape had dropped to his knees and his wand had flown out of his hand.
"Don't kill me! That was not my intention."
Any sound of Dumbledore apparating had been drowned by the sound of the wind in the branches. He stood before Snape, with his robes whipping around him, and his face was illuminated from below in the light cast by his wand.
"Well, Severus, what message does Lord Voldemort have for me?"
"No, no message. I'm here on my own account." Snape was wringing his hands. He looked a little mad, with his straggling black hair flying around him.
I come with a warning. No, a request. Please."
Dumbledore flicked his wand. Though leaves and branches still flew through the night air around them, silence fell on the spot where he and Snape faced each other.
"What request could a Death Eater make of me?"
The prophecy. The prediction. Trelawney."
"Ah, yes," said Dumbledore. "How much did you relay to Lord Voldemort?"
"Everything. Everything I heard," said Snape.
"That is why. It is for that reason. He thinks it means Lily Evans."
"The prophecy did not refer to a woman," said Dumbledore. "It spoke of a boy born at the end of July."
"You know what I mean. He thinks it means her son. He is going to hunt her down, kill them all."
"If she means so much to you," said Dumbledore, "surely Lord Voldemort will spare her. Could you not ask for mercy for the mother in exchange for the son?"
I have asked him."
"You disgust me,"
said Dumbledore, and Harry had never heard so much contempt in his voice. Snape seemed to shrink a little.
"You do not care, then, about the deaths of her husband and child? They can die as long as you have what you want."
Snape said nothing, but merely looked up at Dumbledore.
"Hide them all, then," he croaked. "Keep her, them, safe. Please."
"And what will you give me in return, Severus?"
In return?" Snape gaped at Dumbledore, and Harry expected him to protest. But after a long moment, he said,
"Anything."
The hilltop faded, and Harry stood in Dumbledore's office, and something was making a terrible sound, like a wounded animal. Snape was slumped forward in a chair, and Dumbledore was standing over him, looking grim. After a moment or two, Snape raised his face, and he looked like a man who had lived 100 years of misery since leaving the Wild Hilltop.
"I thought you were going to keep her safe."
"She and James put their faith in the wrong person," said Dumbledore.
"Rather like you, Severus. Weren't you hoping that Lord Voldemort would spare her?"
Snape's breathing was shallow.
"Her boy survives," said Dumbledore.
With a tiny jerk of the head, Snape seemed to flick off an irksome fly.
"Her son lives. He has her eyes. Precisely her eyes. You remember the shape and color of Lily Evans's eyes, I am sure."
"Don't!"
bellowed Snape.
"Gone! Dead! Is this remorse, Severus?"
I wish I were dead."
"And what use would that be to anyone?" said Dumbledore coldly. "If you loved Lily Evans, if you truly loved her, then your way forward is clear."
Snape seemed to peer through a haze of pain, and Dumbledore's words appeared to take a long time to reach him.
"What? What do you mean? You know how and why she died. Make sure it was not in vain. Help me protect Lily's son."
"He does not need protection. The Dark Lord has gone..."
"The Dark Lord will return, and Harry Potter will be in terrible danger when he does."
There was a long pause, and slowly Snape regained control of himself, mastered his own breathing. At last he said,
"Very well. Very well, but never, never tell, Dumbledore. This must be between us. Swear it. I cannot bear, especially Potter's son. I want your word."
"My word, Severus, that I shall never reveal the best of you?"
Dumbledore sighed, looking down into Snape's ferocious, anguished face.
"If you insist."
The office dissolved, but reformed instantly. Snape was pacing up and down in front of Dumbledore.
"Mediocre, arrogant as his father, a determined rule-breaker, delighted to find himself famous, attention-seeking and impertinent."
"You see what you expect to see, Severus," said Dumbledore, without raising his eyes from a copy of Transfiguration Today. "Other teachers report that the boy is modest, likable, and reasonably talented. Personally, I find him an engaging child."
Dumbledore turned a page and said, without looking up,
"Keep an eye on Quirrell, won't you?"
A whirl of color, and now everything darkened, and Snape and Dumbledore stood a little apart in the entrance hall, while the last stragglers from the Yule Ball passed them on their way to bed.
"Well,"
murmured Dumbledore.
"Karkaroff's mark is becoming darker, too. He is panicking. He fears retribution. You know how much help he gave the Ministry after the Dark Lord fell?"
Snape looked sideways at Dumbledore's crooked-nosed profile.
"Karkaroff intends to flee if the mark burns."
"Does he?"
said Dumbledore softly, as Fleur Delacour and Roger Davis came giggling in from the grounds.
"And are you tempted to join him?"
"No,"
said Snape, his black eyes on Fleur's and Roger's retreating figures.
"I am not such a coward."
"No,"
agreed Dumbledore.
"You are a braver man by far than Igor Karkaroff. You know, I sometimes think we sort too soon."
He walked away, leaving Snape looking stricken. And now Harry stood in the headmaster's office yet again. It was night time, and Dumbledore sagged sideways in the throne-like chair behind the desk, apparently semi-conscious. His right hand dangled over the side, blackened and burned. Snape was muttering incantations, pointing his wand at the wrist of the hand, while with his left hand he tipped a goblet full of thick golden potion down Dumbledore's throat. After a moment or two, Dumbledore's eyelids fluttered and opened.
"Why," said Snape, without preamble, "why did you put on that ring? It carries a curse. Surely you realized that. Why even touch it?"
Marvolo Gaunt's ring lay on the desk before Dumbledore. It was cracked. The sword of Gryffindor lay beside it. Dumbledore grimaced.
"I was a fool. Sorely tempted."
"Tempted by what?"
Dumbledore did not answer.
It is a miracle you managed to return here.
Snape sounded furious.
That ring carried a curse of extraordinary power. To contain it is all we can hope for. I have trapped the curse in one hand for the time being.
Dumbledore raised his blackened, useless hand and examined it with the expression of one being shown an interesting curio.
You have done very well, Severus. How long do you think I have?
Dumbledore's tone was conversational. He might have been asking for a weather forecast. Snape hesitated and then said,
I cannot tell. Maybe a year. There is no halting such a spell forever. It will spread eventually. It is the sort of curse that strengthens over time.
Dumbledore smiled. The news that he had less than a year to live seemed a matter of little or no concern to him.
I am fortunate, extremely fortunate that I have you, Severus. If you had only summoned me a little earlier, I might have been able to do more, buy you more time, said Snape furiously.
He looked down at the broken ring and the sword.
Did you think that breaking the ring would break the curse? Something like that. I was delirious, no doubt, said Dumbledore.
With an effort, he straightened himself in his chair.
Well, really, this makes matters much more straightforward.
Snape looked utterly perplexed. Dumbledore smiled.
I refer to the plan Lord Voldemort is revolving around me. His plan to have the poor Malfoy boy murder me.
Snape sat down in the chair Harry had so often occupied, across the desk from Dumbledore. Harry could tell that he wanted to say more on the subject of Dumbledore's cursed hand, but the other held it up in polite refusal to discuss the matter further. Scowling, Snape said,
The Dark Lord does not expect Draco to succeed. This is merely punishment for Lucius's recent failures. Slow torture for Draco's parents while they watch him fail and pay the price. In short, the boy has had a death sentence pronounced upon him as surely as I have, said Dumbledore. Now, I should have thought the natural successor to the job once Draco fails is yourself.
There was a short pause.
That, I think, is the Dark Lord's plan. Lord Voldemort foresees a moment in the near future when he will not need a spy at Hogwarts. He believes the school will soon be in his grasp, yes. And if it does fall into his grasp, said Dumbledore, almost it seemed as an aside, I have your word that you will do all in your power to protect the students of Hogwarts.
Snape gave a stiff nod.
Good. Now then, your first priority will be to discover what Draco is up to. A frightened teenage boy is a danger to others as well as to himself. Offer him help and guidance. He ought to accept. He likes you. Much less since his father has lost favor. Draco blames me. He thinks I have usurped Lucius's position. All the same, try. I am concerned less for myself than for accidental victims of whatever schemes might occur to the boy. Ultimately, of course, there is only one thing to be done if we are to save him from Lord Voldemort's wrath.
Snape raised his eyebrows, and his tone was sardonic as he asked,
Are you intending to let him kill you? Certainly not. You must kill me.
There was a long silence, broken only by an odd clicking noise. Fawkes the Phoenix was gnawing a bit of cuttlebone.
Would you like me to do it now?
Asked Snape, his voice heavy with irony. Or would you like a few moments to compose an epitaph?
Oh, not quite yet, said Dumbledore, smiling. I dare say the moment will present itself in due course. Given what has happened tonight,
he indicated his withered hand,
we can be sure that it will happen within a year. If you don't mind dying, said Snape roughly, why not let Draco do it? That boy's soul is not yet so damaged, said Dumbledore. I would not have it ripped apart on my account. And my soul, Dumbledore? Mine? You alone know whether it will harm your soul to help an old man avoid pain and humiliation, said Dumbledore. I ask this one great favor of you, Severus, because death is coming for me as surely as the Chudley Cannons will finish bottom of this year's league. I confess I should prefer a quick, painless exit to the protracted and messy affair it will be if,
For instance, Greyback is involved. I hear Voldemort has recruited him. Or dear Bellatrix, who likes to play with her food before she eats it.
His tone was light, but his blue eyes pierced Snape as they had frequently pierced Harry, as though the soul they discussed was visible to him. At last Snape gave another curt nod. Dumbledore seemed satisfied.
Thank you, Severus.
The office disappeared, and now Snape and Dumbledore were strolling together in the deserted castle grounds by twilight.
What are you doing with Potter all these evenings you are closeted together? Snape asked abruptly.
Dumbledore looked weary.
Why, you aren't trying to give him more detention, Severus? The boy will soon have spent more time in detention than out.
He is his father over again.
In looks, perhaps, but his deepest nature is much more like his mother's. I spend time with Harry because I have things to discuss with him. Information I must give him before it is too late.
Information, repeated Snape. You trust him? You do not trust me?
It is not a question of trust. I have, as we both know, limited time. It is essential that I give the boy enough information for him to do what he needs to do.
And why may I not have the same information?
I prefer not to put all of my secrets in one basket. Particularly not a basket that spends so much time dangling on the arm of Lord Voldemort,
which I do on your orders.
And you do it extremely well. Do not think that I underestimate the constant danger in which you place yourself, Severus. To give Voldemort what appears to be valuable information while withholding the essentials is a job I would entrust to nobody but you.
Yet you confide much more in a boy who is incapable of occlumency, whose magic is mediocre, and who has a direct connection into the Dark Lord's mind.
Voldemort fears that connection, said Dumbledore. Not so long ago he had one small taste of what truly sharing Harry's mind means to him. It was pain such as he had never experienced. He will not try to possess Harry again, I am sure of it. Not in that way.
I don't understand.
Lord Voldemort's soul, maimed as it is, cannot bear close contact with a soul like Harry's, like a tongue on frozen steel, like flesh in flame.
Souls? We were talking of minds.
In the case of Harry and Lord Voldemort, to speak of one is to speak of the other.
Dumbledore glanced around to make sure that they were alone. They were close by the Forbidden Forest now, but there was no sign of anyone near them.
After you have killed me, Severus, you refuse to tell me everything, yet you expect that small service of me?
Snarled Snape, and real anger flared in the thin face now.
You take a great deal for granted, Dumbledore. Perhaps I have changed my mind.
You gave me your word, Severus, and while we are talking about services you owe me, I thought you agreed to keep a close eye on our young Slytherin friend.
Snape looked angry, mutinous. Dumbledore sighed.
Come to my office tonight, Severus, at 11, and you shall not complain that I have no confidence in you.
They were back in Dumbledore's office, the windows dark, and Fawkes sat silent as Snape sat quite still, as Dumbledore walked around him talking.
Harry must not know. Not until the last moment. Not until it is necessary. Otherwise, how could he have the strength to do what must be done?
But what must he do?
That is between Harry and me. Now, listen closely, Severus. There will come a time after my death. Do not argue. Do not interrupt. There will come a time when Lord Voldemort will seem to fear for the life of his snake.
For Nagini?
Snape looked astonished.
Precisely. If there comes a time when Lord Voldemort stops sending that snake forth to do his bidding, but keeps it safe beside him under magical protection, then, I think, it will be safe to tell Harry.
Tell him what?
Dumbledore took a deep breath and closed his eyes.
Tell him that on the night Lord Voldemort tried to kill him, when Lily cast her own life between them as a shield, the killing curse rebounded upon Lord Voldemort, and a fragment of Voldemort's soul was blasted apart from the whole,
and latched itself onto the only living soul left in that collapsing building. Part of Lord Voldemort lives inside Harry, and it is that which gives him the power of speech with snakes, and a connection with Lord Voldemort's mind that he has never understood. And while that fragment of soul, unmissed by Voldemort, remains attached to and protected by Harry, Lord Voldemort cannot die.
Harry seemed to be watching the two men from one end of a long tunnel. They were so far away from him, their voices echoing strangely in his ears.
"So the boy must die," asked Snape quite calmly. "And Voldemort himself must do it, Severus. That is essential."
Another long silence. Then Snape said,
"I've thought, all these years, that we were protecting him for her, for Lily. We have protected him because it has been essential to teach him, to raise him, to let him try his strength,"
said Dumbledore, his eyes still tight shut.
"Meanwhile, the connection between them grows ever stronger, a parasitic growth. Sometimes I have thought he suspects it himself. If I know him, he will have arranged matters so that when he does set out to meet his death, it will truly mean the end of Voldemort."
Dumbledore opened his eyes. Snape looked horrified.
"You have kept him alive so that he can die at the right moment? Don't be shocked, Severus. How many men and women have you watched die?"
"Lately, only those whom I could not save," said Snape.
He stood up.
"You have used me. Meaning? I have spied for you and lied for you, put myself in mortal danger for you. Everything was supposed to be to keep Lily Potter's son safe. Now you tell me you have been raising him like a pig for slaughter." "But this is touching, Severus,"
said Dumbledore seriously.
"Have you grown to care for the boy, after all?"
"For him?"
shouted Snape.
"Expecto Patronum!"
From the tip of his wand burst the silver doe. She landed on the office floor, bounded once across the office, and soared out of the window. Dumbledore watched her fly away, and as her silvery glow faded, he turned back to Snape, and his eyes were full of tears.
"After all this time?" "Always," said Snape.
And the scene shifted. Now Harry saw Snape talking to the portrait of Dumbledore behind his desk.
"You will have to give Voldemort the correct date of Harry's departure from his aunt and uncle's," said Dumbledore. "Not to do so will raise suspicion when Voldemort believes you so well informed. However, you must plant the idea of decoys. That, I think, ought to ensure Harry's safety. Try confounding Mundungus Fletcher. And Severus, if you are forced to take part in the chase, be sure to act your part convincingly. I am counting upon you to remain in Lord Voldemort's good books as long as possible, or Hogwarts will be left to the mercy of the Carrows."
Now Snape was head-to-head with Mundungus in an unfamiliar tavern, Mundungus's face looking curiously blank, Snape frowning in concentration.
"You will suggest to the Order of the Phoenix," Snape murmured, "that they use decoys, polyjuice potion, identical potters. It is the only thing that might work. You will forget that I have suggested this. You will present it as your own idea. You understand?"
"I understand," murmured Mundungus, his eyes unfocused.
Now Harry was flying alongside Snape on a broomstick through a clear dark night. He was accompanied by other hooded Death Eaters, and ahead were Lupin and a Harry who was really George. A Death Eater moved ahead of Snape and raised his wand, pointing it directly at Lupin's back.
"Sectum Sempra!"
shouted Snape. But the spell, intended for the Death Eater's wand hand, missed and hit George instead. And next, Snape was kneeling in Sirius's old bedroom. Tears were dripping from the end of his hooked nose as he read the old letter from Lily. The second page carried only a few words.
"Could ever have been friends with Galette Grindelwald. I think her mind's going, personally. Loss of love, Lily."
Snape took the page bearing Lily's signature and her love and tucked it inside his robes. Then he ripped in two the photograph he was also holding, so that he kept the part from which Lily laughed, throwing the portion showing James and Harry back onto the floor, under the chest of drawers. And now Snape stood again in the headmaster's study, as Phineas Nigellus came hurrying into his portrait.
"Headmaster, they are camping in the Forest of Dean, the Mudblood.
Do not use that word."
"The Granger girl, then, mentioned the place as she opened her bag, and I heard her."
"Good, very good," cried the portrait of Dumbledore behind the headmaster's chair.
"Now, Severus, the sword. Do not forget that it must be taken under conditions of need and valor, and he must not know that you give it. If Voldemort should read Harry's mind and see you acting for him..."
"I know," said Snape curtly.
He approached the portrait of Dumbledore and pulled at its side. It swung forward, revealing a hidden cavity behind it, from which he took the sword of Gryffindor.
"And you still aren't going to tell me why it's so important to give Potter the sword," said Snape, as he swung a travelling cloak over his robes.
"No, I don't think so," said Dumbledore's portrait. "He will know what to do with it. And Severus, be very careful. They may not take kindly to your appearance after George Weasley's mishap."
Snape turned at the door.
"Don't worry, Dumbledore," he said coolly. "I have a plan."
And Snape left the room. Harry rose up out of the pensive, and moments later, he lay on the carpeted floor in exactly the same room. Snape might just have closed the door. Chapter 34. The Forest Again. Finally, the truth. Lying with his face pressed into the dusty carpet of the office, where he had once thought he was learning the secrets of victory, Harry understood at last that he was not supposed to survive. His job was to walk calmly into death's welcoming arms. Along the way, he was to dispose of Voldemort's remaining links to life, so that when at last he flung himself across Voldemort's path and did not raise a wand to defend himself, the end would be clean, and the job that ought to have been done in Godric's Hollow would be finished. Neither would live. Neither could survive. He felt his heart pounding fiercely in his chest. How strange that in his dread of death it pumped all the harder, valiantly keeping him alive. But it would have to stop, and soon. Its beats were numbered. How many would there be time for as he rose and walked through the castle for the last time, out into the grounds and into the forest? Terror washed over him as he lay on the floor with that funeral drum pounding inside him. Would it hurt to die? All those times he had thought that it was about to happen and escaped, he had never really thought of the thing itself. His will to live had always been so much stronger than his fear of death. Yet it did not occur to him now to try to escape, to outrun Voldemort. It was over, he knew it, and all that was left was the thing itself, dying. If he could only have died on that summer's night when he had left Number 4 Privet Drive for the last time, when the noble Phoenix Feather Wand had saved him. If he could only have died like Hedwig, so quickly, he would not have known it had happened. Or if he could have launched himself in front of a wand to save someone he loved. He envied even his parents' deaths now. This cold-blooded walk to his own destruction would require a different kind of bravery. He felt his fingers trembling slightly, and made an effort to control them, although no one could see him. The portraits on the walls were all empty. Slowly, very slowly, he sat up, and as he did so, he felt more alive and more aware of his own living body than ever before. Why had he never appreciated what a miracle he was? Brain and nerve and bounding heart. It would all be gone, or at least he would be gone from it. His breath came slow and deep, and his mouth and throat were completely dry. But so were his eyes. Dumbledore's betrayal was almost nothing. Of course there had been a bigger plan. Harry had simply been too foolish to see it. He realized that now. He had never questioned his own assumption that Dumbledore wanted him alive. Now he saw that his lifespan had always been determined by how long it took to eliminate all the Horcruxes. Dumbledore had passed the job of destroying them to him, and obediently he had continued to chip away at the bonds tying not only Voldemort, but himself to life. How neat, how elegant, not to waste any more lives, but to give the dangerous task to the boy who had already been marked for slaughter. and whose death would not be a calamity, but another blow against Voldemort. And Dumbledore had known that Harry would not duck out, that he would keep going to the end, even though it was his end. Because he had taken trouble to get to know him, hadn't he? Dumbledore knew, as Voldemort knew, that Harry would not let anyone else die for him, now that he had discovered it was in his power to stop it. The images of Fred, Lupin, and Tonks lying dead in the Great Hall forced their way back into his mind's eye, and for a moment he could hardly breathe. Death was impatient. But Dumbledore had overestimated him. He had failed. The snake survived. One Horcrux remained to bind Voldemort to the earth, even after Harry had been killed. True, that would mean an easier job for somebody. He wondered who would do it. Ron and Hermione would know what needed to be done, of course. That would have been why Dumbledore wanted him to confide in two others, so that if he fulfilled his true destiny a little early, they could carry on. Like rain on a cold window, these thoughts pattered against the hard surface of the incontrovertible truth, which was that he must die. I must die. It must end. Ron and Hermione seemed a long way away, in a far-off country. He felt as though he had parted from them long ago. There would be no goodbyes and no explanations, he was determined of that. This was a journey they could not take together, and the attempts they would make to stop him would waste valuable time. He looked down at the battered gold watch he had received on his 17th birthday. Nearly half of the hour allotted by Voldemort for his surrender had elapsed. He stood up. His heart was leaping against his ribs like a frantic bird. Perhaps it knew it had little time left. Perhaps it was determined to fulfill a lifetime's beats before the end. He did not look back as he closed the office door. The castle was empty. He felt ghostly, striding through it alone, as if he had already died. The portrait people were still missing from their frames. The whole place was eerily still, as if all its remaining lifeblood were concentrated in the great hall, where the dead and the mourners were crammed. Harry pulled the invisibility cloak over himself and descended through the floors, at last walking down the marble staircase into the entrance hall. Perhaps some tiny part of him hoped to be sensed, to be seen, to be stopped. But the cloak was, as ever, impenetrable, perfect, and he reached the front doors easily. Then Neville nearly walked into him. He was one half of a pair that was carrying a body in from the grounds. Harry glanced down and felt another dull blow to his stomach. Colin Creevy, though underage, must have sneaked back just as Malfoy, Crabbe, and Goyle had done. He was tiny in death.
"You know what? I can manage him alone, Neville," said Oliver Wood, and he heaved Colin over his shoulder in a fireman's lift and carried him into the great hall.
Neville leaned against the doorframe for a moment and wiped his forehead with the back of his hand. He looked like an old man. Then he set off down the steps again into the darkness to recover more bodies. Harry took one glance back at the entrance of the great hall. People were moving around, trying to comfort each other, drinking, kneeling beside the dead, but he could not see any of the people he loved. No hint of Hermione, Ron, Ginny, or any of the other Weasleys. No Luna. He felt he would have given all the time remaining to him for just one last look at them. But then, would he ever have the strength to stop looking? It was better like this. He moved down the steps and out into the darkness. It was nearly 4 in the morning, and the deathly stillness of the grounds felt as though they were holding their breath, waiting to see whether he could do what he must. Harry moved toward Neville, who was bending over another body.
"Neville! Blimey, Harry! You nearly gave me heart failure!"
Harry had pulled off the cloak. The idea had come to him out of nowhere, born out of a desire to make absolutely sure.
"Where are you going, alone?"
Neville asked suspiciously.
"It's all part of the plan," said Harry. "There's something I've got to do. Listen, Neville." "Harry?"
Neville looked suddenly scared.
"Harry, you're not thinking of handing yourself over?"
"No," Harry lied easily. "Course not. This is something else, but I might be out of sight for a while. You know Voldemort's snake, Neville? He's got a huge snake. Calls it Nagini."
"I've heard, yeah. What about it?"
"It's got to be killed. Ron and Hermione know that, but just in case they..." The awfulness of that possibility smothered him for a moment, made it impossible to keep talking. But he pulled himself together again. This was crucial. He must be like Dumbledore. Keep a cool head. Make sure there were backups, others to carry on. Dumbledore had died knowing that three people still knew about the Horcruxes. Now Neville would take Harry's place. There would still be three in the secret.
Just in case they're busy, and you get the chance, kill the snake?
Kill the snake, Harry repeated.
All right, Harry. You're okay, are you? I'm fine. Thanks, Neville.
But Neville seized his wrist as Harry made to move on.
We're all going to keep fighting, Harry. You know that. Yeah, I...
The suffocating feeling extinguished the end of the sentence. He could not go on. Neville did not seem to find it strange. He patted Harry on the shoulder, released him, and walked away to look for more bodies. Harry swung the cloak back over himself and walked on. Someone else was moving, not far away, stooping over another prone figure on the ground. He was feet away from her when he realized it was Ginny. He stopped in his tracks. She was crouching over a girl who was whispering for her mother.
It's all right, Ginny was saying. It's okay. We're going to get you inside.
But I want to go home, whispered the girl. I don't want to fight anymore.
I know,
said Ginny, and her voice broke.
It's going to be all right.
Ripples of cold undulated over Harry's skin. He wanted to shout out to the night. He wanted Ginny to know that he was there. He wanted her to know where he was going. He wanted to be stopped, to be dragged back, to be sent back home. But he was home. Hogwarts was the first and best home he had known. He and Voldemort and Snape, the abandoned boys, had all found home here. Ginny was kneeling beside the injured girl now, holding her hand. With a huge effort, Harry forced himself on. He thought he saw Ginny look around as he passed, and wondered whether she had sensed someone walking nearby. But he did not speak, and he did not look back. Hagrid's hut loomed out of the darkness. There were no lights, no sound of fangs scrabbling at the door, his bark booming in welcome. All those visits to Hagrid, and the gleam of the copper kettle on the fire, and rock cakes, and giant grubs, and his great bearded face, and Ron vomiting slugs, and Hermione helping him save Norbert. He moved on, and now he reached the edge of the forest, and he stopped. A swarm of Dementors was gliding amongst the trees. He could feel their chill, and he was not sure he would be able to pass safely through it. He had no strength left for a Patronus. He could no longer control his own trembling. It was not, after all, so easy to die. Every second he breathed, the smell of the grass, the cool air on his face, was so precious. To think that people had years and years, time to waste, so much time it dragged, and he was clinging to each second. At the same time, he thought that he would not be able to go on, and knew that he must. The long game was ended. The snitch had been caught. It was time to leave the air.
The snitch.
His nerveless fingers fumbled for a moment with the pouch at his neck, and he pulled it out.
I open at the close.
Breathing fast and hard, he stared down at it. Now that he wanted time to move as slowly as possible, it seemed to have sped up, and understanding was coming so fast it seemed to have bypassed thought. This was the close. This was the moment. He pressed the golden metal to his lips and whispered,
I am about to die.
The metal shell broke open. He lowered his shaking hand, raised Draco's wand beneath the cloak and murmured,
Lumos!
The black stone with its jagged crack running down the center sat in the two halves of the snitch. The resurrection stone had cracked down the vertical line representing the Elder Wand. The triangle and circle representing the cloak and the stone were still discernible. And again, Harry understood without having to think. It did not matter about bringing them back, for he was about to join them. He was not really fetching them. They were fetching him. He closed his eyes and turned the stone over in his hand three times. He knew it had happened, because he heard slight movements around him, that suggested frail bodies shifting their footing on the earthy, twig-strewn ground that marked the outer edge of the forest. He opened his eyes and looked around. They were neither ghost nor truly flesh. He could see that. They resembled most closely the riddle that had escaped from the diary so long ago, and he had been memory made nearly solid. Less substantial than living bodies, but much more than ghosts, they moved toward him, and on each face there was the same loving smile. James was exactly the same height as Harry. He was wearing the clothes in which he had died, and his hair was untidy and ruffled, and his glasses were a little lopsided, like Mr. Weasley's. Sirius was tall and handsome, and younger by far than Harry had seen him in life. He loped with an easy grace, his hands in his pockets and a grin on his face. Lupin was younger too, and much less shabby, and his hair was thicker and darker. He looked happy to be back in this familiar place, scene of so many adolescent wanderings. Lily's smile was widest of all. She pushed her long hair back as she drew close to him, and her green eyes, so like his, searched his face hungrily, as though she would never be able to look at him enough.
"You've been so brave."
He could not speak. His eyes feasted on her, and he thought that he would like to stand and look at her forever, and that would be enough.
"You are nearly there," said James. "Very close. We are so proud of you. Does it hurt?"
The childish question had fallen from Harry's lips before he could stop it.
"Dying? Not at all," said Sirius. "Quicker and easier than falling asleep." "And he will want it to be quick. He wants it over," said Lupin. "I didn't want you to die," Harry said.
These words came without his volition.
"Any of you. I'm sorry."
He addressed Lupin more than any of them, beseeching him.
"Right after you'd had your son, Remus. I'm sorry." "I am sorry too," said Lupin. "Sorry, I will never know him. But he will know why I died, and I hope he will understand. I was trying to make a world in which he could live a happier life."
A chilly breeze that seemed to emanate from the heart of the forest lifted the hair at Harry's brow. He knew that they would not tell him to go, that it would have to be his decision.
"You'll stay with me?" "Until the very end," said James. "They won't be able to see you?" asked Harry.
"We are part of you," said Sirius, "invisible to anyone else."
Harry looked at his mother.
"Stay close to me," he said quietly.
And he set off. The Dementor's chill did not overcome him. He passed through it with his companions, and they acted like Patronuses to him. And together they marched through the old trees that grew closely together, their branches tangled, their roots gnarled and twisted underfoot. Harry clutched the cloak tightly around him in the darkness, travelling deeper and deeper into the forest, with no idea where exactly Voldemort was, but sure that he would find him. Beside him, making scarcely a sound, walked James, Sirius, Lupin, and Lily. And their presence was his courage, and the reason he was able to keep putting one foot in front of the other. His body and mind felt oddly disconnected now, his limbs working without conscious instruction, as if he were passenger, not driver, in the body he was about to leave. The dead who walked beside him through the forest were much more real to him now than the living back at the castle. Ron, Hermione, Ginny, and all the others were the ones who felt like ghosts as he stumbled and slipped toward the end of his life, toward Voldemort. A thud and a whisper. Some other living creature had stirred close by. Harry stopped under the cloak, peering around, listening, and his mother and father, Lupin and Sirius, stopped too.
"Someone there,"
came a rough whisper close at hand.
"He's got an invisibility cloak. Could it be?"
Two figures emerged from behind a nearby tree. Their wands flared, and Harry saw Yaxley and Dolohov peering into the darkness, directly at the place Harry, his mother and father, and Sirius and Lupin stood. Apparently they could not see anything.
"Definitely heard something," said Yaxley. "Animal, do you reckon? That headcase Hagrid kept a whole bunch of stuff in here,"
said Dolohov, glancing over his shoulder. Yaxley looked down at his watch.
"Time's nearly up," Potter's had his hour. He's not coming. And he was sure he'd come. He won't be happy. Better go back, said Yaxley. Find out what the plan is now.
He and Dolohov turned and walked deeper into the forest. Harry followed them, knowing that they would lead him exactly where he wanted to go. He glanced sideways, and his mother smiled at him, and his father nodded encouragement. They had travelled on mere minutes when Harry saw light ahead, and Yaxley and Dolohov stepped out into a clearing that Harry knew had been the place where the monstrous Aragog had once lived. The remnants of his vast web were still there, but the swarm of descendants he had spawned had been driven out by the Death Eaters to fight for their cause. A fire burned in the middle of the clearing, and its flickering light fell over a crowd of completely silent, watchful Death Eaters. Some of them were still masked and hooded. Others showed their faces. Two giants sat on the outskirts of the group, casting massive shadows over the scene, their faces cruel, rough-hewn like rock. Harry saw Fenrir skulking, chewing his long nails. The great blonde Rowl was dabbing at his bleeding lip. He saw Lucius Malfoy, who looked defeated and terrified, and Narcissa, whose eyes were sunken and full of apprehension. Every eye was fixed upon Voldemort, who stood with his head bowed and his white hands folded over the Elder Wand in front of him. He might have been praying or else counting silently in his mind, and Harry, standing still on the edge of the scene, thought absurdly of a child counting in a game of hide-and-seek. Behind his head, still swirling and coiling, the great snake Nagini floated in her glittering, charmed cage, like a monstrous halo. When Dolohov and Yaxley rejoined the circle, Voldemort looked up.
"No sign of him, my lord," said Dolohov.
Voldemort's expression did not change. The red eyes seemed to burn in the firelight. Slowly he drew the Elder Wand between his long fingers.
"My lord,"
Bellatrix had spoken. She sat closest to Voldemort, disheveled, her face a little bloody but otherwise unharmed. Voldemort raised his hand to silence her, and she did not speak another word, but eyed him in worshipful fascination.
"I thought you would come,"
said Voldemort in his high, clear voice, his eyes on the leaping flames.
"I expected him to come."
Nobody spoke. They seemed as scared as Harry, whose heart was now throwing itself against his ribs as though determined to escape the body he was about to cast aside. His hands were sweating as he pulled off the invisibility cloak and stuffed it beneath his robes with his wand. He did not want to be tempted to fight.
"I was, it seems, mistaken,"
said Voldemort.
"You weren't!"
Harry said it as loudly as he could, with all the force he could muster. He did not want to sound afraid. The resurrection stone slipped from between his numb fingers, and out of the corner of his eyes he saw his parents, Sirius and Lupin, vanish as he stepped forward into the firelight. At that moment, he felt that nobody mattered but Voldemort. It was just the two of them. The illusion was gone as soon as it had come. The giants roared as the Death Eaters rose together, and there were many cries, gasps, even laughter. Voldemort had frozen where he stood, but his red eyes had found Harry, and he stared as Harry moved toward him with nothing but the fire between them. Then a voice yelled,
"Harry, no!"
He turned. Hagrid was bound and trussed, tied to a tree nearby. His massive body shook the branches overhead as he struggled, desperate.
"No! No! Harry! What are you... Quiet!"
shouted Rowl, and with a flick of his wand, Hagrid was silenced. Bellatrix, who had leapt to her feet, was looking eagerly from Voldemort to Harry, her breast heaving. The only things that moved were the flames and the snake, coiling and uncoiling in the glittering cage behind Voldemort's head. Harry could feel his wand against his chest, but he made no attempt to draw it. He knew that the snake was too well protected, knew that if he managed to point the wand at Nagini, 50 curses would hit him first. And still, Voldemort and Harry looked at each other. And now Voldemort tilted his head a little to the side, considering the boy standing before him, and a singularly mirthless smile curled the lipless mouth.
"Harry Potter,"
he said very softly. His voice might have been part of the spitting fire.
"The boy.